Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, North Korea is among a small number of countries in the world reporting to be free of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. The country is also among those least prepared for a coronavirus outbreak. Katharina Zellweger is the director of CoreAid, a non-governmental organization based in Hong Kong. She said that North Korea closed its border with China at the end of January, quarantined foreigners, and enforced travel restrictions within the country. She explained that North Korea took these measures early because officials there are afraid the country cannot deal with a virus spread. She added, "I do think the North Korean government is very well aware of how weak their healthcare system is." North Korea rated very poorly in a 2019 study by the U.S.-based Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. The country placed 193rd out of the 195 countries included in the yearly examination. Only Somalia and Equatorial Guinea were found to be more insecure. The center released the report in October. The study measured each country's level of preparedness for a major infectious disease spread. North Korea scored a 0 in infection control plans and measures and availability of equipment. An expert on North Korea's healthcare system told VOA that the system of testing and diagnosing an infectious disease is non-existent in North Korea. The expert, who did not want to be identified, said only a few hospitals can carry out blood tests. Ki Park is a teacher at Harvard Medical School in the American state of Massachusetts. He spoke at a recent meeting held by the U.S. Institute of Peace. He said, "North Korea's medical system is fragile and weak, and they're only able to treat only a handful of critically ill patients." Park has been working with North Korean doctors for the past 13 years in medical aid programs. He noted new models by Imperial College London help show how COVID-19 cases in North Korea would quickly grow beyond its hospital system's treatment abilities. Park said he thinks the North Koreans succeeded in stopping COVID-19. He said North Korean officials should continue with preventative measures until a vaccine or other treatment is available. The World Food Program recently reported that North Korea faces damage to its economy because of the COVID-19 crisis. Aid workers say the crisis is already creating related problems, especially in production and transport of agricultural goods. Scott Snyder is director of the U.S.-Korea Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. He warns that North Korea's COVID-19 quarantine measures may give more control to the government. He said, quarantine increases the scarcity of goods and in turn increases internal dependency on the leadership.
Portugal has increased government efforts to support the country's struggling Roma communities during the coronavirus crisis. But rights groups say more help is needed. Many families have not been able to earn money since street markets and fairs were closed. Portugal citizens have been under stay-at-home orders since March 18th in an effort to slow the spread of the new coronavirus. The country has about 37,000 people who belong to the minority Roma ethnic community. Many Roma in Portugal and in other European nations face discrimination, poverty, and social isolation. Portugal's government recently introduced additional measures for Roma communities after 33 people at a settlement were confirmed to have COVID-19, the disease the virus causes. The settlement in the country's southeastern Alentejo area is home to about 200 people. After the coronavirus cases were discovered, the settlement was closed off and carefully cleaned. Local officials then took food and medicine to the people as stay-at-home orders continued. In the beginning, those in the settlement had to pay for the goods. But Claudia Pereira, Secretary of State for Integration and Migration, told the Reuters news agency that those who are not currently earning any money can now receive goods for free. Pereira said the government and local officials are also working to provide support to other Roma communities in need across the country. Some of these communities live in places with no conditions, in tents and camps, she said. Some don't have access to drinking water. The lack of government support in the beginning led activist Bruno Gonçalves to lead efforts to buy food vouchers for some needy families. Gonçalves belongs to the organization Letras Nomadas, which seeks to help Portugal's Roma communities. Gonçalves now fears government support will fail to reach everyone. He said there is hunger in the community because of the closures of street markets and gatherings. Those who lived off selling two or three shirts a day are in a very complicated situation, he said. These people have no savings. The government has introduced other measures to help hard-hit families during the coronavirus crisis. These include the temporary suspension of electricity and water shutoffs, as well as financial support for some housing payments. But Gonçalves said many Portuguese Roma, especially older people, find it hard to complete the necessary paperwork to receive government help. This is because there are several steps in the process and some community members cannot read. Gonçalves added, "The Roma are not counted. We are often forgotten." I'm Brian Lynn.
This is Everyday Grammar, and today I'll start the program with a question. If I told you to touch your toes, would you know where to find these body parts? A toe is one of the five separate parts at the end of each foot. If you did not know that, you are not alone. Many English learners need practice at learning the names of parts of the body. On recent programs, I talked about grammar games that you can play at home, like Jeopardy and Questions and Answers. Today's game is one that will help you remember anatomy words as you also practice using the imperative, the grammatical form used in commands. The game is called Simon Says, and you can play it with people at home and on video calls. Many Americans played Simon Says as children, but of course, we were using our native language. Playing the game in a foreign language is a totally different experience. It makes the game more challenging and turns it into a learning tool. But it is also fun. Simon Says is a physical game, and you can play it inside your home or outside in the yard. In addition to using the imperative and building your vocabulary, Simon Says also helps you practice saying and hearing new words in English. You will even get a little physical exercise and hopefully a few laughs. To start the game, you will need 3 or more players, but no more than 8. This way, everyone can see the movements of the other players. One player at a time leads the game. The leader calls out commands to the group. If the leader says, "Simon says," in ordering the command, the other players must carry out that command. But if the words "Simon says" are not included in the command, the players must remain still. Listen to this example, and you'll hear what I mean. Simon says, "Jump on one foot." Simon says, "Look up." Simon says, "Touch your ears." Simon says, "Run in place." Turn around. If any players turn around on the last command, they lose and leave the game. The last player remaining in the game wins. Then, the winning player can become the leader, and everyone plays again. Or, if no one wins, the group can choose a new leader. Now that you know how the game works, we can talk a little bit more about the imperative. Did you notice that I used only the imperative form in the commands? I said, for example, "Simon says, touch your ears." The command there is "touch your ears," and the verb is "touch." English commands begin with a verb and use the shortest verb form with no S ending. Players giving commands cannot use questions such as, "Simon says, can you turn around?" or modal verbs as in, "Simon says you must turn around." Neither of these are examples of the imperative form. One small piece of advice. Before starting the game, choose a level of difficulty based on the English skills of the players. You can make the game easier or harder by giving commands more quickly or slowly and by choosing vocabulary that is easy or hard. Well, that's all for today's program. Simon says, try playing the game and let us know how it goes. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another strategic arms reduction treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
My fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The Council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.